Hi there, American Beyond. It's Alton Brown and the Alton Brown Cast, which typically records from in a little padded room above my garage in Atlanta, Georgia. But actually, today we're in New York City working on a remote because we had to come here for interesting people. No, that's wrong. There are interesting people in Atlanta, but I just know more interesting people in New York because I do a lot more work here. Anyway, getting myself in deep. Today on the show, we're going to do our usual examination, close, in-depth journalistic examination of food news of the day. We're also going to take your calls, hopefully culinary in nature, since that's most of what I know about. We're going to answer some questions from the internet and then also interview a fascinating personality. And we've got a doozy today. We've got this is a chef that I admire greatly, but I'd like to actually say is a friend of mine, Alex Guarnaschelli. Alex Guarnaschelli, of course, is now an Iron Chef, so I really should say Iron Chef Alex Guarnaschelli. And she's got a fabulous new cookbook that's got some really almost kind of dirty food pictures. I mean, they're very sensuous and incredibly desirable. I cut one particular picture out of a cake and carry it with me in my wallet. Anyway, Alex Guarnaschelli will be on the show momentarily when she gets here, because I got to tell you, she's always late. I was thinking about beverages. One of the big questions I'm asked during summertime when it's really, really hot down here in Georgia, people ask me, what do you make to drink? What kind of refreshment? And I have to tell you, I know that the American thing to say is lemonade. But you know what? I don't really think of lemons as a summer fruit. I mean, they're no better in summer than winter. Most of the lemons in this country, the Eureka variety, they grow year round. It's kind of like tomatoes. They're not that great. Meyer lemons are great, but that's a winter fruit. So I have to tell you that the beverage that I enjoy most and find most refreshment out of comes from the cucumber. I do not agree with the venerable Samuel Johnson, who once said, "It has been a common saying of physicians in England that a cucumber should be well sliced and dressed with pepper and vinegar and then thrown out as good for nothing." I disagree completely. I'm not a really big fan of making cucumbers into things other than pickles, which I adore, but I do like them a great deal in beverages. And I will make up cucumber water. Basically, I just grate cucumbers. So we're talking about the standard slicing cucumber. You know, there are three kinds, basically. All cucumbers, which are members of the Cucurbitaceae family. I left a syllable out. Cucurbitaceae family. That's a hard word to say. It's a melon, essentially, because it grows on a vine and has seeds. They're edible in this case, though. You've got your slicing cucumbers, your pickling cucumbers, and your burpless cucumbers. And we'll talk about the whole burping thing later. But I just take a nice big garden variety cucumber. I grate it on a box grater into water. Let it soak. If I'm going to make that into cocktails, I'll also add some sugar and make that into a sugar syrup, barely bringing it up to a simmer and then cooling it down. Strain out the cucumbers, and then I pour that over the rocks with some gin and just a little bit of lime juice for acidity, and finish that with a fresh round of cucumber. Oh my, that's good stuff. Or you can just make that syrup and add to seltzer water, and you've got a cucumber soda. I think it is a far more refreshing flavor than lemon. So, you know, we may come back and talk about cucumbers a few times during the show. I'm going to make that the food of the day. The cucumber is the food of the day. Alton Brown here. You're listening to the Alton Brown Cast, and this is the section of the show where we deal with some news items that we're following in the world of food. Looking now at an interesting article from Scientific American, which I have to read with a dictionary next to me because I don't understand so many of the words. Kyle Hill wrote this, and it's about eating bug parts. Now, a lot of people, I've been reading, you know, at the UN and different places, where these kind of initiatives to get people to actually start eating bugs, because in the end, it's going to be the protein source that is most readily available to most people living on the planet, and probably the most nutritious. Sorry, it's just it's true. But this article is about the fact that most of us already are eating a fair number of bugs and just don't realize it. And this is because of the way that the rules and the laws are written, at least here in the United States, as to how much bug content you can have in food. And most people don't want to really talk about this. But the truth is, bugs like thrips, which are very, very small, and aphids, are in a great deal of our food. If you go by the FDA guidelines, it says that by the time that you eat 1,000 kilograms of spinach, which is a lot of spinach, you'll have eaten a quarter pounder's worth of aphids. And I'm sorry, and how how many lifetimes would it take me to eat 1,000 kilograms of spinach? An awful lot. Says that beer is also a major contributing factor to your bug intake. A lot of the bugs and bug parts are filtered out during brewing, but the FDA's limit on the hops that go into beer tanks is 2,500 aphids per 10 grams of hops. So what that means basically is that 5% of the total weight of the hops that are making it into your beer can be bug, just, you know, the flavor of bug, and maybe they're good. Also, this article references desserts. It says that by the time you eat 100 kilograms of your favorite chocolate, of course, that's a lot of chocolate, you've eaten a full kilogram of bugs. And I imagine that that's because of the aging and, I mean, the drying and fermenting process of cocoa nibs, which is done outside. As for bread, it says about, 1.5 kilograms of insect is sprinkled into every 100 kilograms of flour that you use. It's just there as a natural byproduct. Industry, of course, does their best to minimize this, but insects are a viable and plentiful, nutritious food source. So maybe we should embrace that, or at least not be so creeped out by it. I know Andrew Zimmern's not. He eats bugs all the time. I like Smithsonian Magazine, and I saw this recently. It was a piece about the fact that lobsters aren't immortal. Turns out there's been some talk on the internet and social media saying that lobsters don't actually ever age, and that if you leave them alone, they just don't die. They don't show typical signs of a phenomenon called senescence, which means they don't age the way other creatures do. Their metabolism doesn't slow down. They can reproduce for a really long time. But the truth is they do actually die. There is been some new research says that European lobster, male lobsters in the wild live the average of 31 years. Females have average of 54 years, which means, of course, that the females are on their second or third lobster husband. The ones that die at 31 typically throw themselves into lobster traps at an early age because they're so sick of listening to their wives complain. So we see that nature works just the same in lobsters as it does in humans. Everybody knows how I feel about kosher salt and salt in general. I am a salt fan. I think that learning how and knowing how to handle salt and season food properly is a big deal. I also really don't believe that it's the sodium that we use at home that's killing us off in droves. The IOM was asked apparently by the CDC to review and assess the study. And its processes, approaches, and whatnot, and the conclusions about sodium intake as they relate directly to health outcomes. In general, it says here, the IOM found the new studies, quote, are not consistent in their methodological approaches to measuring sodium intake, and that they have any limitations related to the quality of those measures and the quantity of available evidence assessing sodium intake and health outcomes. So who knows? The problems here may have just been the way that the study was designed, but once again, it points us to the fact that salt is still, you know, under the gun. People are suspicious of it. Some people are going to want to take it out, some people not, but we still do not have actual proof that, by and large, most of us should be cutting back on salt. The evidence is still just not there yet, so we'll keep watching that. Mayor Bloomberg, I'm sure, will be on it immediately. NPR. Through their writer Allison Aubrey, reporting that apparently Bill Gates is investing in chickenless eggs. All right, he's involved in this company apparently at Hampton Creek Foods, San Francisco. Okay, that makes some sense because they're kind of usually on the cutting edge of these things. This egg product apparently made from bits of ground up pea, sorghum, a few other ingredients. It's getting some real attention from high tech investors apparently, like Gates, who feels that the planet cannot sustain the current rate of growth in animal based foods any longer. A big part of the environmental footprint of eggs and meat is the amount of course, water and land it takes to grow the grain that's fed to animals used in food production. And so they're believing now that what we need is an egg that doesn't actually have any egg in it. And I call that, I just rather not eat eggs. The day that I turn around and eat an egg made from ground up peas, sorghum, and quote, a few other ingredients, I'm sorry, that's no longer an egg. That's an egg analog, and I don't want to eat that. I want to eat eggs. And you know what? as far as I'm concerned, chickens, especially if they're raised by people and not on farms and not in big industrial, you know, operations, if people were able to just raise their own freaking chickens and let them eat bugs out of the yard and stuff like that, we'd have all the eggs we need. We'd have, you know, nice little birds running around. We could have stew every now and then. But, you know, the problem is that it's been made just about impossible for people to raise eggs and raise chickens in most parts of the United States. The answer, I'm sorry, I don't think it's to make an artificial freaking egg. It's to give everybody a chicken. Sorry, that's just the way I feel. All right, I have to admit, I don't often go by any USDA or other federal agency websites in order to get food news because things are usually kind of stale and not always, I don't know, newsworthy. But, I mean, occasionally you find something that kind of is a cool thing to find out. And today I found actually this is a blog. It's the USDA blog written by Marianne Gravely, a technical information specialist, food safety and inspection service person from the USDA. And I like this because it's something that I feel kind of needs to be dealt with in food. And what it's about is, the name of the article is "Before You Toss Food, Wait, Check It Out." And I like that because the truth is we throw away a lot of food that we shouldn't be throwing away. And I feel partly responsible because I know in the early days of my food TV shows, I was such a stickler about food sanitation and spent a lot of time talking about the horrible, horrible bugs that you can get if food goes bad. But here's the thing. Most of the stuff that is in our pantries, most of the stuff in our freezer certainly, and a lot of the stuff in our refrigerators may be fine even though they're past their use-by dates or you know, kind of a little bit beyond prime, if you will. I mean, here's a good, for instance, which is something that Ms. Gravely mentions in her article. She talks about, for instance, ground meat that has been frozen. She says, you know, foods that have been in the freezer for months may be dry or not taste as good, but they will be safe to eat. Why? Because food poisoning or the bacteria and various organisms that cause food poisoning will not grow at freezer temperatures. They just won't. You get freezer burn, a lot of other things. But as she points out here, if you find that ground meat, don't throw it away. Make chili out of it. And this is a completely reasonable, smart approach. There is no reason to get rid of this food. The same is true of most of the use-by dates that you see on not only canned food, but other packaged foods. These are kind of arbitrary numbers sometimes, or it's maybe a date that is made up because a manufacturer believes that at that point, their food won't be 100% as good anymore. And of course, they don't want you breaking into your box of crackers or cereal or whatever and find that it's not at its absolute best. But let's face it, kids. Is it going to kill you to eat a cracker that's, you know, 99% what it used to be instead of 100%? No. My rule is this, whether this is certainly true also of cooked food in the refrigerator, okay? Once it's been cooked, food in the refrigerator, even meat, doesn't go bad for a really, really long time. It may become unappetizing. It may become a little odd, but odds are nothing is going to hurt you. Okay, what's going to hurt you is coming home from the market with ground meat or chicken or something and not cooking it properly because the microbes that made it in from the animal through the slaughtering process or were even picked up in the slaughtering process, those are the things that you need to worry about. So for me, take a look at it. You know what? I've cut mold off of cheese. Okay, I have spooned some mold off of yogurt because it happens all the time, and I am not about to throw out a $4-5 container of yogurt just because it's got a little mold on top. I'll take some of that off and move on. It's like ice cream. If the ice cream gets a little crunchy on the top surface, by the way, if you have ice cream, what you need to do is after you've taken some of the ice cream out, just press some plastic wrap or butcher paper right down on top of the surface of the ice cream. That'll prevent that freezer burn. Just saying. So Americans, just, you know, lighten up. Don't think that those dates are absolute. It's not like you hit a use-by date on a carton of eggs. The eggs are going to make you explode. No. And in fact, eggs, I've never seen an egg go bad. I've seen eggs come into the house bad, but I've never seen them go bad. Typically, they just dry up, and it takes a really long time. So back to this article. It's a pretty good one. You could just search for USDA food blog, "Before You Toss Food, Wait, Check It Out." Because she gives a couple of different suggestions for using things. For instance, if you're looking at cans, don't worry about dates so much. If it's got no rusts, no dents, no swelling, it's probably okay. And apparently, there's a website that you can go to. I'm actually going to click on it right now, called Shelf Stable Food. And that is part of the Food Safety Inspection Service. I'm going to try to give the Well, that's a really long URL, so I think I'm just going to tweet it. But there, if you were to Google USDA shelf-stable food safety, I think that you would find a lot of information that would help you to save some money. And let's face it, there's nothing worse than, you know, like really needing to get supper done and you pull something out and realize, oh my gosh, it's past its date. Relax. Odds are it's okay. All right, let's move on. I was on the subject of cucumbers, and I wanted to throw out a few fun cucumber facts because I know a lot of people don't respect the cucumber the way they should. Just want to mention, a lot of vitamin A. You got pantothenic acid, magnesium, phosphorus, and manganese. Of course, it's like 96% water, so it's obviously a very low-fat, low-calorie kind of food. So that's just something to think about. 8 calories for half a cup. Oh, and they've also got vitamin C, vitamin K, and potassium. Just saying. So welcome to the Alton Browncast, recording on the road this week from beautiful New York City, where I had to come in order to have a conversation with my guest that's in front of me, who, as far as I know, never actually leaves New York unless she's going to Europe. I'm talking to Iron Chef Alex Guarnaschelli. Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Given your heritage,
yes.
your life.
Yeah.
I don't think that many people realize who your mom is.
Yeah.
And who taught you.
Mm-hmm.
Maria Guarnaschelli's a legend. If you've ever written a cookbook or if you've read any of the great cookbooks going back to, into the 70s. I mean, she was doing this. I don't know. Do you know what the very first big, what was the big breaking cookbook that she edited? Do you remember?
I remember my mom did a book called Dancing Disco.
Okay, I don't know that one.
Well, I love, she laughs about it all the time, which had like the foot imprints on how to make the disco steps.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was so excited about her disco book. And I said, Mom, just disco, really? Then she read a 4-sentence blurb in the back of the New York Times in, you know, like the real estate issue about a woman who was cooking with spices and making Indian food in Brooklyn Heights. She clipped it out, I remember, and she held it and she said, "We're going to find this woman." And we went, and that woman was Julie Sani, who wrote Classic Indian Cooking. That book was published in 1980 and is still in print,
yep.
Which is unbelievable. And is still available at any Barnes & Noble. I mean, I just consider that an Indian cookbook that's all black and white illustrations, no photographs, still in print.
Well, that's because when people ask about Indian cooking, that book still is in the top five reference points for real Indian cooking. I have at least one copy of it, and I would still say that it's like the joy of cooking for Indian cuisine.
Another book my mom revised in 1997.
97, yeah.
So that took 4 years of all-nighters. I mean, my mom just didn't sleep. She just...
This is not usual. You know...
No, I don't know.
Cookbook editors don't typically do what I've understood your mom does, which is basically live that book. When I've heard you talk about your childhood and about her constant cooking, that was working on projects.
Totally.
Well, in this day and age, most cookbook editors are not going home and doing all of this cooking.
I don't know
it's
why
like
they're
It's like she
not.
Was co-authoring in a way. I mean,
yeah.
what was her process and what was her way of explaining? And this is interesting because I think it has a lot to do with who you became as a cook. Her hands-on involvement in this process... How did she make that jibe with reality? It's such a strange approach.
Well,
wonderful approach, but strange approach.
You don't.
No.
No, I don't think you function in reality at all. I don't. You know, my mother would get the manuscript and start cooking, and so for a year we ate nothing but that book. And my father just said, "I can't have another dal, and I can't have another masala, and you know, I can't have any more mowed lawn." My father called most of Julie Sani's cooking mowed lawn, and I agree. I remember it being somewhat grassy. 1978 was a grassy year at the table. But my mother just, there was no other option. I don't remember looking at my mother and thinking, well, you could do this or you could do that, in any state of despair. Even now, and I find my mother, if my mom doesn't want to do it, she's not going to do it. She doesn't care. You know, she said, I sent Charlie Trotter away with his books. She said, because I don't understand it. She said, I don't understand his cooking. It's not for me. And I think he's wonderful, but I'm not going to do a book that's not for me. She's turned away many other way even bigger people. So I used to go to parties, and people would say, I know your mom. She declined my book. you know, that's a real conversation starter. You end up with a vodka soda in the bathroom because you're hiding from people that have been declined. But I think you're right. There, you just go through the whole process. You absolutely must live and breathe it, every page, or it's not going to work out.
I don't think that any of my cookbooks, none of my editors took the manuscript home and cooked it. I'm sure of it.
I've cooked a lot from your cookbooks.
Yeah, but you were my book editor. I mean, what I mean is that's not what editors typically do. I think it's thrilling, and I hope that the people that got turned down by your mom realize that in a way they were saving themselves potential anguish, because I'm sure, you know,
yes.
I mean, there were plenty of people that your mom started that cooking process and had to really make huge changes to make things work when she realized that things weren't going the way they ought to go.
My mother would say, I'm not going to take so-and-so on because they're not going to do the work with me. You know, like a trainer to the stars, you know, would take a client like Madonna, who's going to go to the gym for 6 hours a day without batting an eye.
Mm-hmm.
But someone who's at home with a bag of cheese doodles is not going to win any prize at the county fair. And my mother, I think, evaluated the universe in that way. That was her value system. Are you going to do the work with me? Are you going to tolerate that I'm going to function at this level? But then there are people that, you know, just throw themselves at my mother's feet and say, I don't know what I would have done if...
if you hadn't been there.
Yeah, but let me be clear. Many more people don't like my mother than like her.
Which, as far as I'm concerned, is an endorsement.
<You're>
I mean, frankly, because she's not running a popularity, you know, contest.
No, but I mean, it's kind of easier living. And I think my mother is rogue. You know, my mom's just she's just rogue. She really, truly is. She just doesn't. My mother really doesn't care.
Was that the biggest influence on your cooking?
Mm.
Was your not only what your mom cooked, but how she went about it?
Totally. Alton, I have only learned this recently. That, you know, I definitely have this mindset of, if you haven't made that 70 times, then you don't really know how to make it. I mean, that's sort of what I say to myself. And it's limiting. But it's also, you can sleep at night really well. And I am a big fan of sleeping really well at night. I just say, I don't know how to do that. I'm not going to do it. Yes, I would love to do, I'd love to make sushi. I'd love to have a sushi bar. That's the number one thing that pops into my head. I'd love to have a sushi bar, but the amount of work that I would have to do to make peace with me to do it is just not even worth trying. No, I'll just stick to chicken liver on toast and be quiet about it.
And go enjoy sushi somewhere else.
Yes.
With somebody that did do the 20 years of cutting one fish.
Yeah, I mean, Gerald dreams of sushi as a movie just seem normal to me. It seemed like, what else would they do?
Yeah.
And I mean, you think about that guy drying the seaweed, I mean, for hours every day and saying, I don't really know how to do this. I think my mom kind of comes cut from some of that cloth, that it takes so much to really be an authority on something. But I just think you're right, that an editor who's sort of evaluating and putting together material for an authority, that she felt compelled and still does to be as knowledgeable and understanding as the writer themselves. I mean, that's unusual, but it's definitely affected my cooking. I think, you know, for Iron Chef, I'll tell you that the amount of things that I did to practice to make what little food I actually... You don't have to make a lot of food if you think about it. You don't. What you have to do is make really the best choices you can possibly make and walk away from things that you just say, no, under this amount of pressure, in this context, with these limitations, I can't make the 7,000 things I want to make. I can only make actually 10 of them. Now I have to pick wisely from those 10 and get past everything and just do it. So you end up, you know, poaching an egg or making a souffle or a sandwich.
Why would a person like you, who's come from the place that you've come from, want to freaking be an Iron Chef to begin with? Because it doesn't fit.
Right. That's right.
Is that just you being rogue?
Yeah, I think, well, Alton, how do we not talk about you? I guess I have to figure that out.
What do you mean, as far as Iron Chef goes?
Yes. How do we? No, don't.
No,
I don't want to hear it.
I'm not down there. I'm not down there in Kitchen Stadium.
If we're going to, I'm going to have to leave.
But
you're
why
not gonna,
would you want
so,
to be an Iron Chef?
Because
you really did.
I want to be, because it's just the only actual legit food superhero that there is to want to be in the world.
You could have gone and kicked ass on Top Chef.
Totally. I got asked to do that show many times. But it felt, it didn't feel real. I mean, Iron Chef America is so real. Like, imagine putting on television the whole process of making that food. The technique. It's all about technique. it doesn't even matter if you show the faces sometimes. I mean, you think about how much time is spent just pure cooking and movement, and that reveals a side of cooking that you don't see on any other show, and you never will. You never will.
Do you think that any part of your desire to go through that process might be based on the fact that doing it is an act of refinement of who you are as a cook?
No. Nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Because I've heard some people say that it boils you down to the essence of who you are as
totally.
A cook, and that you discover things about yourself out of that.
Totally.
I don't mean it makes you practice or makes you better at a cook. Just makes you, kind of boils you down in a way.
It does all of those things. It strips you. You
know, is
you
that
go
valuable?
That. I mean, what else would you want to do with your time, quite honestly? I can't think of anything I'd rather do.
On a beach and drink daiquiris comes to mind.
Yeah, I understand. But I mean, if you could cook lobster in the pulsating sunlight in Southern California and strip yourself down.
Which you've done, by the way.
Yeah, I think.
On the beach.
Remember, just honestly, it all comes down to garlic and shallots and lemon juice. And just having the courage to look at all that stuff and just say, no, I'm sorry. It isn't about the frou-frou, this, that, the other. Just do the thing. Just do the thing that, you know, like the right amount of acid, the right temperature, the right amount of shallots and white wine and acidity and a bay leaf floating in there and, you know, stirring it with a fresh sprig of thyme and then throwing it away and knowing that there's just that whisper. You know, just timing, Alton. Cooking is all about timing and the amount of time that you allow everything to happen. That's all cooking is to me. And I think, God, you know, this is so, I'm so privileged. I get to be filmed and other people get to watch me do this. What more would you want to do with your time? I don't get it. Is there something else? Because I have yet to find anything else that thrills me as much as that little pit in that room and the smell of dry ice and shiitake mushrooms, because that's what Kitchen Stadium smells like.
Dry ice and smoke machines and shiitake mushrooms.
It always smells like shiitakes.
Do you remember what you did with lobsters on the beach? You remember in Next Iron Chef?
Every breathing moment.
I remember because nobody had ever done anything like that before. You remember how many different ways did you cook lobster? Do you remember?
I do. I cooked someone right on a rack.
Yep.
On the fryer.
You grilled them. Direct heat.
A direct heat. Then I wrapped some in Reynolds foil. I laid them out and I wrapped them and I just put them right in the fire. Then I just put a few right on the fire. Then I took a salad bowl that had no business being in that pit, and I put it in there with water and I boiled the lobsters. So I think four.
But your whole thing, your whole angle was you were going to wait and see which of those you liked best and only serve that.
Yes, fully.
See, nobody in that competition, and I know because I'm a professional voyeur in those cases. I'm watching. And everyone else, their whole thing is decide what I am going to do to the food, and I am going to do that. And that's what I'm going to do. And you took this entire different tact of I don't know exactly how this is going to go. So I'm going to employ multiple techniques, and then I'm going to triage it out. I'd never seen anybody do that before. And you won that round.
I knew that the water boiled lobster would be the best. I knew this. We know this.
Then why did you bother with the others?
Because I thought, what if when I'm not looking, the fire gets too intense in one area or another? And remember, you had to share a pit with another cook, and that other cook maybe didn't want the fire to be so good in your area. Maybe someone like, you know, I shared a pit with Nate. And Nate Appleman is an amazing cook, a ferocious competitor.
He'd throw you under the bus in a heartbeat.
He sure would, and that's why I like him so much, because so would I.
Yeah.
But I thought, no, I have to trust Nate, the fire, the beach, the wind, the sun, you with your little camera poking it in our heads. I had to peel garlic and shallots and limes, and I had to get a lot of things. And I thought, well, what if the water boils too vigorously at any point or another? Then I'll end up with a perfectly cooked but chewy
lobster.
Yeah, and I thought, no, we can't have... But you mean other people didn't cook multiple different...
No, not very often at all. What most people in those competitions do is they decide on a path, and then they doggedly go down that path, even beyond the point of doom. I mean, you know, it's not working. It's not working. This is going to suck. And they will not veer, because once they've determined the path, they cannot move off the path. You paved multiple paths, and then later on chose which one you wanted to take.
This
is extraordinary lobster.
It really was. I couldn't believe it.
You didn't muck it up. You know, I swear, I think a lot of being a good cook is first do no harm.
Do you, which Indiana Jones is it where he goes in the room and looks for the Holy Grail?
Well, the Holy Grail, that is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And he's in the room with all of the different cups, and it's the simple one. Yeah.
So it's really hard to get behind. Yeah. It's really hard to get beyond the glitter and the jewels with food because food's so sexy. And the pantry was always so bursting.
Look at all this good stuff.
Yeah, oh, I can make this, and I'm going to add this, and I'm going to add that. And then you just, the second time I looked at the pantry, I looked past all that stuff, and I just said, I want lemons and limes and bay leaf and shallots and garlic. And you know what's really hard, Alton, is to peel garlic and shallots under pressure. I know that this sounds silly, but it's very hard to peel a clove of garlic when you're freaking out. It's the hardest thing to do. And I just thought, you will be disciplined, and you will peel this goddamn garlic, and you will just do that, and you will be still. Imagine how hard it was to be still. Do you know how long it takes to peel a clove of garlic?
When you're thinking about it, yeah, it takes forever. And when a camera's rolling, it takes forever times two.
And then, yeah, I definitely knew that I had to strip it down and just be real with it. And, you know, just I figured I could win the whole thing with lemon juice. This is what I thought the first day. I thought, lemon juice, just the right amount of lemon juice everywhere, no matter what you're making, and you will win this.
Did you win with lemon juice?
I think vinegar, and lemon juice. Yeah, I would say acidity is what saved me in most cases. I felt I really, I understand that. This is what I really understand about cooking. What little you know you understand, go with that.
Why didn't you win the first time?
Oh,
first Iron Chef, an ex-Iron Chef, you did not win.
Oh, I so did not win. I did not, I wouldn't have been content had I won.
Did you get beat or did you lose?
I lost.
Why? What do you think did it?
Alton,
because I don't know.
Would you believe me if I said to you that I was so tired?
I don't even know why.
I think I drained myself.
Because it's grueling.
Yeah, but the second, you know, I exercised a lot after that happened, and I thought you will be in better shape, and you need more stamina. First of all, second of all,
but now you know what stamina is. Look at the kitchens you worked in France. These were serious kitchens. These are kitchens that make me shudder to think about being in, and you had the stamina for it.
Yeah, I think I needed someone to tell me. I don't know. I needed some kind of odd permission. I know this isn't a therapy session, but I needed some strange permission that I deserved to win outside of myself. And I found it in a few different places unexpectedly. And I think if I hadn't done it the first time, first of all, when we came to the finale and it was Jeffrey and Elizabeth, and they said, we want Alex to cook for 15 minutes with each of us, there wasn't a person who didn't feel I deserved to be there. And so that really...
You're about to say accept.
Accept myself.
Okay. Because that wasn't important. I wanted to hear what accept
was
going to lead
to. Yes, fair enough. And then Bobby came in with, I think, Michael Simon and Maury Meadow, and he said, you should be down there and not them. Really mad. You know, tough love times 7,000 plus 8 million infinity squared. And I thought, you know, okay, easy for you to say, buddy. I mean, but meanwhile, who am I to say that to him? Look at all the competition he's done.
So yeah, but he didn't have to win a spot on the board.
Fair enough. But I filed that. There's a thin file of stuff that you file and you don't lose. And that was filed. And so when it came, I didn't think I'd get another opportunity. And I thought, all right, you know what? That wasn't in the cards for me. And when they asked me to do it again, I said, I'm not doing this again. Definitely not. And someone else who had competed before me went to Bobby and said, I don't want to do it again. Do I have to? And he said, no, you don't. So I marched over to his office and I said, I'm going to get permission to not do this again.
Why did you feel you needed permission?
I don't know.
Sure as hell didn't need it from him.
He's kind of got, I think he's sort of, because he produced Alex's Day Off and because he sort of said, I didn't like your first cooking show and we need to make a cooking show where you just cook. I sort of felt like he would strip it down for me, the stripping that I couldn't do.
And okay, I'll go that.
It had to do with the cooking show that he produced and the way he did it. He stood over me and he just said, you know, come on, stop thinking about it. Just shut up and make the food and do the thing. So I went over to his office and I said, I'm not going to do Next Iron Chef again. I don't have to do this. I can sit on the beach and drink daiquiris. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I went over there and I said it. And he said, if you win, it'll change your career forever, and you really need that kind of validation for yourself. He said, so you're going to do it again and get out of my office.
Has it changed?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
You've
if
only
it
come out the
career.
Other end to find that there is no secret ingredient. I mean, what are you saying?
Yeah, okay, right. Kind of like in Kung Fu Panda when the dragon scroll is just a mirror that looks at you.
Yeah, totally.
Who cares? Who cares? It's so not the point.
You cared up until the point you won.
I didn't care about my career and what it would do for my career or anything else.
You just wanted to do it.
I just wanted to win. Just really wanted to win for myself. I know it sounds like, you know, I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and breathed that air for me and, you know, all that crap. You know what? Yeah, I'll get down with that. I'll get into the new agey aspect of it. We can play a little Yanni, Elton. We can play a little Yanni.
Let's just say we did and not actually play the Yanni.
It was for me, only for me. And by the way, like, I'll never forget the look on your face standing there with that curtain and you were saying, I don't know who won. This is the first time I don't know who won this. You remember
I wasn't lying to you.
It was obvious you weren't lying.
No, I wasn't lying. They did not tell me. Because I don't, you know why? Because I'm always afraid that if they tell me, that I'll somehow telegraph it.
You will.
So I'm like, I don't want to know. It's not that they wouldn't tell me. I don't want to be told.
You do telegraph, but you telegraph by not looking.
Well, that's what tells you. If I'm not looking at you, I know.
Yeah, but you might be looking at the person who didn't win would be what I think you would do.
I'm not that good of an actor.
Or shoes. You really are. No. Shoes.
Shoes.
You focus on shoes when you don't know what to do. Nice shoes.
Nice.
And I think, oh, God, he's in shoe mode.
It's the shoe
we
thing.
We are screwed.
And that was a big picture of you, though, on the wall.
I thought it was Amanda Freitag because you could see through the curtain and we have a similar hairdo. And I said, oh, my God, it's Amanda's hair. Oh, my God. All right. Okay. Let's talk Cornish.
Damage control.
How are we going to not cry, A of one, because an Iron Chef or a next Iron Chef does not cry
no
in
crying.
Kitchen Stadium.
Absolutely.
No crying, no laughing, no giggling. Be humble. Be macho. Be bold. Be all the
gracious.
Gracious. Yes, in the face of defeat. Oh, I had all this, and I'm looking over, and Jeffrey and Bobby and Donatella and Simon, they're all standing there, and I just thought, oh, my God, and I'm leaning over, and that director is saying, you have to stand up. Stand up. And there it was. Oh, my God. I could have died right there.
Some of us thought you might.
I thought.
There were a few of us that thought, Amanda's going down. I mean, Amanda's gone, and then Alex is going to be standing there, and then she's going to fall out dead.
The big moment was when I cooked the duck against Marcel, and you came over to me, and you just said, you got to keep it together. And I really felt very zen. I mean, I really felt like, yeah, wax on, wax off.
Yeah.
Sand the floor.
Yeah,
yes.
Sand the floor.
Yeah.
You have seen, as I have, a lot of cooks that we've known and worked with become empire builders and kind of just replicate restaurants all over the place. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are some people that can do that and still keep it all together and keep the quality and keep the soul? Or is there a point where that doesn't matter anymore?
Maybe the soul is about all that growth and not soul the way you and I look at soul.
Hmm.
Because I think that some people really, you know, I think Jeffrey is that way. I think Jeffrey likes to spread the seed.
Jeffrey.
Yeah, I do.
So you think, is that a matter of kind of cloning himself then? Does he train people?
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether any of them really reflect his true sensibility. I think the Lamb's Club has a lot of his style, much more so than the National.
Right.
You can see Jeffrey, you know, you pick up a glass, it's a certain shape.
This is Jeffrey.
That's that aesthetic thing that is really as important to Jeffrey as the taste of the food.
Now, you talk about going to Lamb's Club and having it. Well, the way you describe it almost makes it sound like, you know, it's his living room. You know, it's
yes.
You're out his house.
Yes.
And you pick up things and you're like, oh, that's him. Okay, same at Butter?
No. I have yet to open the restaurant that is actually what I want. I don't really want a restaurant, Elton. I would really like to have, I met Ina Garten the other day.
Mm-hmm. And I've never met her.
Never
been in the same space with her.
Believe
She's a
that.
Phantom. No, I swear I have never seen the woman in the flesh.
You'd be very
or in
happy.
The denim, I guess, is the way that...
You'd
all right, go ahead.
Happy.
I interrupt your story. So you meet Ina Garten. What effect did this have?
Well, first of all, it felt like meeting my mother, quite frankly. She's a lot like my mother. Very bright, high-functioning, you know, looking around, not saying too much. But she mentioned that she worked at the White House and left her job at the White House, I guess, in the mid-70s. And she said, I can't believe I actually looked at the president and the first lady and said, I'm leaving because I'm going to go open a grocery store.
Which president was that? I'm trying to do the math.
I don't know. It would have been Carter.
Carter?
I think so, Carter, right?
Carter.
So I really want to open a grocery store. I really do. I really am a curator of ingredients. I like certain vinegars. I like certain vegetables. I like them to be just so. I could spend all my time. I mean, not unlike maybe creating an art exhibit where you would walk in and it would feel curated. And you can do what you want in there. I'm not going to control you. I only want to really meticulously curate a grocery store with a community table. And we make food every day that you really want to eat. You don't go in and say... You go in and you say, I know whatever I get is going to be so damn delicious, I don't know what to do with myself.
I can completely see you in a place that is a grocery store, and in the middle of the grocery store is just a big table.
Yeah.
With maybe 20 seats.
Yes.
And that's all there is, and people just rotate in so that everything's community, and you're just serving whatever happens to hit you that day.
Yes.
And that's it.
That's it.
You do it for so many hours, and then that's it. We're done, you know?
I would love that.
So what exactly would be stopping you from doing that? I mean, you're at a point now where you need to call those kinds of shots, don't you think?
I do. I grew up in Midtown Manhattan, Alton. I grew up with parents who have lived in the same rental apartment for 45 years.
What's their rent, do you think? Or do they own? They own?
No, they
still rent?
Rent.
Renting for 40 years?
It's rent stabilized.
But it's like $60 a month kind
right.
of thing, right?
Yeah, it's about
Never
50,
understood
50
how that
bucks.
Works. Not being a New Yorker, I have no idea how that works.
But I think, you know, I see what happens with rents and spaces, and it literally is the thing that holds me back. It's not being free-minded enough to pick the space and say, this is exactly where I want it, and not be afraid of paying that rent and paying people and being responsible to other people. You know, we're not fully adults, any of us. And
I don't want to be an adult. I've known
no
adults,
desire.
And they're boring as hell.
Yeah, agree.
I mean,
well, you're not boring at all.
Well, because I'm not a grown-up.
You send...
I'm not a grown-up.
I know we're not going to get to talking about you very much because I know how you're going to deflect.
Yeah, I'm very good at that.
You're a deflector, and
I'm
that's
deflector.
Fine.
No,
and don't think that it's going unseen by everyone. But you, you know, you do send a thrill up people's spines. Men, women of all ages. You do. You know you do.
No, I haven't ever thought it through that way. I'm not sure I want to.
You walk in a room with a briefcase and there's magic Wizard of Oz dust inside. And you're going to pick who you get to sprinkle it on and when it gets sprinkled. And when you're not looking, you get magic dust. And when you look desperately for magic dust, you don't get any.
Do I have any here now? Where's the
vanish?
Where's the magic?
And you vanish like no other human. You're a vanisher.
I do vanish.
You vanish.
I do.
I
slip away very, very efficiently.
I have been standing next to you and turned, you know, cartoonishly to speak. And there's like... still air that has moved from
it's like
you leaving.
Cary Grant and the Bishop's Wife. You just have this poof. But I'm not an angel by any stretch of the imagination. I have to say this. Hey, thank you for the whole magic dust thing. You could leave New York and go do this somewhere else.
I couldn't. No.
You could. Your new book.
My only.
Your new book. Your only book. Old School Comfort Food. And
yes.
I always look at the title of that because it's... almost to me, I guess it strikes me as old school and comfort food are kind of almost the same thing in a way. I mean, what
yes.
is there, new school comfort food?
Fair enough.
But you wanted to delineate that this wasn't some new comfort food. This is old school comfort food.
Yes.
And it is.
It's a giant disclaimer.
And I want to say that actually my favorite thing about the book, and I've spent a good bit of time with the book, is actually, and I bet this is something nobody has said. The photos remind me of your food tweets because you, more than anyone, have been able to just throw together a few, you know, warm English muffins, elderberry jam. So, you know, I think you're constantly riffing on starfish and coffee a little bit when you kind of lay these things out. But you do have this ability to conjure deep. Sensory kind of emotions by just making these kind of food haikus. What was your last one? Do you remember what your last one was? It was one of your food tweets?
No, I don't know if this is my latest, but my favorite is definitely talking about fried eggs. I mean, I would, for example, say that if you could imagine a perfectly warm fried egg with those lacy, buttery edges and that perfectly oozing yolk, just put on the right, just imagine the sound of that landing on a crispy English muffin with a little bit of butter and salt right on the English muffin, and then just that little bit of jam kind of peeking through. I think it's like Bob Ross. You know, remember the painting? He would paint and say,
"No, this is nothing like Bob Ross." I mean, that's very...
It's in my future.
...evocative and very sensorially... sensuous. It's sensuous. And the photographs in the book, Old School Comfort Food, are very you. You know, a lot of people write books, and somebody comes in and shoots the photographs, and you're like, oh... A glossy photograph where I can tell somebody placed the sesame seeds with tweezers. No, you're
messy.
It's dirty.
It's messy.
There's dirtiness in
there. Have you seen that chocolate cake with the caramel on it?
I don't want to talk about it because I cut out that picture and carry it with me sometimes because it's naughty. That's a naughty picture of cake, Alex.
No.
And the thing is it looks like you just made the cake and cut the cake and the cake was photographed. Boom. And it was probably like done in your apartment or something. Because it didn't even feel like a studio.
It was that way. The shoot was that way. And I cooked a lot of the food with the stylist. We cooked, you know, again, my mother, we go back to this whole idea of going through the whole process.
But so your mom didn't edit this book.
My mom barely saw it. My mom read.
Did your mom offer to edit your book?
No.
Did you ask? Your mother did.
No, come on. I would.
She could have turned you down.
It.
No. Yeah. I don't think you're willing to
do
the work.
You're not going to do the work. That's right. She actually said to me when I said I'm doing Next Iron Chef again, she said, don't do that. You're not good at those competition shows.
Oh, she did she?
Yeah.
Did she tell you what you needed to hear?
No, not at all. In fact, I stay far away from my mother when there's something I need of that nature.
Sometimes a parent will say something. Because they know it loads the gun.
No. Mm-mm. You do that, maybe. Do you do that as a parent?
I try not to. I try not to be that manipulative guy. I try not to be that person. But I did manipulate my daughter a lot when she was young about food. People ask me, how did you get your daughter to eat food that she didn't want to eat? My answer was always, by not giving it to her. No, darling, that's for grown-ups. You can't have any of that.
Are you serious?
Oh, yeah. And she's like, well, I don't like that. I want some of that. And then, of course, she takes it, even if she doesn't like it, she's not going to say so because she doesn't want to be the little kid. My whole thing was to never give her the stuff that I really wanted her to eat.
That's horrible and fantastic.
Fantastic. Yes. She doesn't know it. One day I'll tell her.
By the way, you do that with everything. You do that on television, too.
I do, a little bit.
What are you making? Why are you making that? Do you think that you should be? Are you making it for yourself or for someone else? Do you want to be an Iron Chef or are you just cooking for the sake of cooking?
Same thing. That's very manipulative. I shouldn't do that. But it's partly my job.
Keep calm and carry on. I love it. It really just, that just is like a huge log in the furnace. And that just, I mean, for anybody who's worth having around, if you ask me.
I do want you to tell me about the lemonade stand thing.
Honestly, as a chef, you do a lot of charity events, and you work with a lot of charities. And then I think eventually, as you do with your own cooking, you kind of whittle it down to the things that resonate with you. Alex's Lemonade Stand is the little girl who had an incurable cancer, got all these treatments, and one of them made her feel better. And she came home and she said, Mom, Dad, that made me feel better. And if I can do something so that other kids in my situation can have that same treatment, great. I'm going to put a lemonade stand out in the yard, mm-hmm. and I'm going to sell lemonade and give the money to cancer research. And so they called, you know, the local press, this, that, sure. and they wound up creating these lemonade stands. There's National Lemonade Stand Days where they go around, where they happen all around the country. They've partnered with Toys R Us, who's given a lot of money, and it's become a real thing. And to me, I don't know, hearing her parents talk about the story and the way a child can make your whole life better and different is something that I live with my own daughter.
Thanks for coming, Alex.
My pleasure.
All right, now it's time to answer some of your questions, so let's get to that. Jade, this is Alton Brown. How are you, ma'am?
I am good, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. Where are you?
I am in Wichita.
What question do you have for me?
Well, I have a scenario for you. I was just wondering, let's say you have 4 hours until dinner, and you missed lunch, and the grocery store is out of sardines. What would you choose for a snack?
Cottage cheese with almonds.
Nice. Mixed in or separate?
Yes, mixed in. I would simply take some salted, roasted almonds and just mix them into a few ounces of cottage cheese because that's going to give me some protein. It's going to give me some fiber. It's going to give me some calcium. It's going to give me a little bit of fat. Going to give me some carbohydrate. It'll get me through. So that's what I would do.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're very, very welcome. And we're moving on to another call of someone else who's perfectly willing to waste a few moments blabbering with me about food or anything. By the way, I'll talk about stuff that's got nothing to do with food. I'm happy to do that. Elijah, are you there with me now?
Yeah. Hi, Alton.
Hey, how are you?
My question was, recently I've gotten a slight anosmia where I don't smell stuff as well, so it's kind of muted my taste a little. But I could still smell stuff that's very fragrant, and I was just wondering, is there anything that you know that's very flavorful and fragrant to cook or to make that would help with the problem?
Sure. I actually I grew up with my grandmother on my mom's side had lost her sense of smell as a result of, I think it was scarlet fever or one of those terrible things when she was a kid and didn't have had almost no sense of smell at all. So I have some experience around this. One of the things that I would suggest, if you really, you know, a lot of people that don't have a sense of smell tend to not, you know, obviously care about how fragrant the food is, and they just concentrate on the major chemical senses, you know, sweet, salty, bitter, and the like. But if you can smell some, then you're going to obviously want to do some things that have a great deal of fragrance in them. Let me ask you a question. What kinds of things do you find that you can smell?
Well, I was making the guacamole from Dip Madness, and when I opened up the cumin, that was a smell that was very strong to me and that stuck with me for a good bit.
Okay, well, that's good. That actually tells us a whole lot. I would suggest that you become an enthusiast of Middle Eastern cooking. Middle Eastern cooking that uses, because you're going to be able to smell most curry mixtures. You're going to be able to smell things like coriander. You're probably going to smell cinnamon quite readily. You're going to be able to smell, of course, cumin, which happens to be my favorite spice, so I'm with you on that. Another Middle Eastern spice that I've gotten to where I work with a lot these days, fenugreek. You're going to be able to smell sumac. So I would suggest you get hold of a book or a magazine and go online and start playing with some Mediterranean stews and other recipes that use a lot of strong spice mixtures. Northern African dishes, tagines, and things like that. You can look up T-A-G-I-N-E-S, I think it is, because those kinds of stews where you've got a long exposure to heat of a bunch of spices are really, 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 really going to make your house smell great. And it sounds to me like if you can smell cumin, you'll definitely be able to detect those as well.
Cool. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Bye. Continuing on the Elton Brown cast, I'm going to read a couple of questions that have come in from our email bag from askelton@eltonbrown.com. Oh, I like this one. This is from a guy named Clint Carroll. It says, I know your background is in film, which is true. I've been in the production business pretty much my whole life, but I've never really heard you discuss film. Well, that's a shame because I talk about it all the time. Can you talk about your favorite movies, directors, etc.? My favorite movie of all time is Jaws. Because it's a beautiful love story, and beautifully told. So that's my favorite. Casablanca would be in my top five. 2001, A Space Odyssey, definitely in my top five. And I like that movie especially because girls hate it. I've never met a girl that liked 2001, which somehow makes me just like it a little bit more. And I'd have to throw at least one Hitchcock in there. Although, unlike most people, I'm not a really big Vertigo fan. I never thought Vertigo was that good. I got to go with Psycho 100%. But I would definitely have to have some Alfred Hitchcock in there. So, you know, that's a few of my absolute favorites. And maybe I'll compile a whole, you know, kind of secondary list, or I can do some like European directors, you know, get some Fellini in there and then get some Kurosawa from, you know, from Japan and stuff like that. But that's for another time. Here's a question that I'm glad to be asked by Facebook or anywhere, actually, because I think it's important. Lee Smith asks, how old is old enough to let your child start using a chef's knife? Now, that's a loaded question, because I think that kids should start using knives early. I put the first paring knife in my daughter's hand when she was five. Chef's knife is a whole other issue. Little hands aren't ready for a blade that size, you know, because chef's knives, you know, typically that style of blade, you know, you're talking about a knife anywhere from 6-inch blade up to 10 or even 12-inch blade. I've seen 14, but only crazy, you know, serial killers have those. But that knife requires some real hand skills, some hand-eye coordination, wrist strength. So that's not a knife that I would put in anybody's hand under probably 12. But certainly, a paring knife and other smaller handled knives, I think, are perfectly fine and necessary. Because if you don't give your kid a knife until they're, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, they're that's just way too late. You know, they really need to get into that while their hands are really developing so that they get that muscle memory going. So I say get a little knife, a little paring knife, and a box of Band-Aids and start teaching your kid when they're younger. I know you guys listening to the Alton Browncast probably getting sick of me mentioning cucumber in this show. I just had cucumber on my mind. I just want to mention some other things you can do with cucumber. Of course, there are a lot of different cucumber salads you can make. They marinate very, very, very well. My favorite thing is to make beverages with them. I mentioned the syrup that you can make. But I also blend them in the smoothies because that way you get the fiber, which is really good for you. They go very well with mint. So whenever I make a cucumber salad, I usually put mint in there. They go very, very well with gin, as we all know. You should. And then they also pair well with a lemon verbena, which is also very tasty. So just a couple of things that you might think about in the old flavor combinations. As far as cooking them, unless you're making syrup, I really wouldn't bother. Oh, and the other way you can make syrup is to actually make a equal part sugar, water, simple syrup. Of course, bring them together at equal parts. Bring it to a boil to a fully dissolved, cooling it partially, and then just pouring it over finely chopped cucumbers. Another great way of making a cucumber syrup. I promise, I'm going to shut up about cucumbers now. Right, internet people, that is enough for today. I'm Alton Brown. This has been the Alton Brown Cast. We've had a lot of fun, had a great interview with Alex Cornishelli. Thank her again for being here. And we'll be back soon with another fun-filled episode of the Brown Cast. And until then, America, cook smart.